I thought it might be interesting to compare my solution to this problem with yours. Okay, so how many mono and di substituted structures do you have for Dewar's models if they were three-dimensional with tetrahedral carbons? Okay, so you have obviously a mono there and a mono there. And how about the blue mono? Is that different from the red mono? No, you can rotate it like that. Okay. How about that blue mono? Is that different from the red one in front? No, you can rotate it and get. But there's the question about that one, right? Because you can't rotate it and get that one to superimpose on the other one. So if there's meaning to the third dimension, then that one's going to be different, right? So there are at least two isomers, the top and the bottom. And if these non-planar structures mean something, there's an additional one, which I put in parentheses. Okay, now you can do the same thing there because the general shape is the same of the arrangement of the hydrogens. Okay, here there are obviously three different positions you could put a mono substituent. And in each case, there's right and left. And you can't rotate this one because the H's in the middle are sticking out as shown, and if you rotate it at 180 degrees, they'd be pointing back, so they aren't going to superimpose. So there'd be three isomers if the space doesn't count, and three more if it does. These have two and one. We don't need, I think, go through that. That one would have, if you assume that the methyl group down at the bottom left can rotate so that those hydrogens are equivalent one to the other, then you have one in the top, one to the bottom right, one to the bottom left on the methyl group. And there'd be another one because the two on the top could not be superimposed, right, by rotation. Okay, so that would be, if the third dimension counts, there's another one there. And in the case of prismane, there's only one mono substituted, as Ladenburg said. Now, in the case of di, you can have, if you have one at the top, then you can have another one here, another one here, another one here, right? But then there's the question of these two. You could get those two more if you have to take account of three dimensions. Same thing here. If you start, forget the top, if they're all on the bottom, you can have this one and this one, this one and this one, this one and this one. And those three will all be different. And in fact, this one and this one, as compared to this pair here, are not superimposable by rotation. Okay? So that would be an additional one you get there. So in all, you'd have six, but another three if you count mirror images. And you can do analogous things here. I don't think I need go through all these. You actually did it for a problem. But I just thought it would be handy to have it there to compare with your answers. And Van't Hoff, remember, was the one that pointed out that there'd be an additional isomer if you can count mirror images here, because this one and this one is not superimposable on this one and this one. Okay. And Van't Hoff made these cardboard models that I showed you last time. It's interesting to look at them to see how they're made. Here's some cardboard models like that of a tetrahedral carbon. That's the way he said to make it. And notice the arrangement, the tetrahedral arrangement can be either the points are arranged tetrahedrally or the faces. It's the same relationship among the four. So you see that sometimes he colored the faces to show different groups attached to them and mirror images that were not superimposable. And sometimes he colored the vertices. Okay? Incidentally, what are these things here? Those are not tetrahedra. Why did he make those models? What is he trying to show with those? Aha, he's trying to show the prismane, the Ladenburg benzene, right? That this one and the one with this one and this one colored are not superimposable on one another. Okay, so those are Ladenburg benzenes. Now, fumaric and maleic acids have a double bond. So he points out with these models, and indicating red where it could be colored in red, that if you make a double bond between these two, the reds could either be opposite one another or adjacent to one another. So you'd expect two isomers, as indeed these two isomers were known, of the compound with that constitutional formula, a double bond between the central carbons. Now, how could you tell? Suppose you had, they had these two compounds. Fumaric acid, the name comes from fume. It's like in smoke, right? Maleic comes from apples. Okay, but how? So you have these two. How do you know which one is the one on the left and which one is the one on the right if you have these two pure bottles? Can you imagine doing any experiment that could have been done then that could distinguish between those? Well, what you notice is that in one case, in the case of maleic acid, the two red things are near one another, and they're far from one another in this case. Okay. Or if you look at modern models, this is the one, the fumaric acid, where they're far from one another, right? And this is the one you'd have if they were near one another, right, with an OH on here for those two. And that means that these two things are near one another, right? And in fact, they can react with one another by losing water and forming an oxygen bridge between these two. Right? Which, notice, I couldn't make in these models without breaking them. Right? So there's always the question of what about the models is real and what isn't. I mean, that's not something that was intended in the models, how rigid they should be. Right? But might it be realistic that it's hard to get those two things together? And we'll talk about that aspect that's called strain pretty soon. Anyhow, that was a way of distinguishing, because you can make maleic anhydride, but you can't make fumaric anhydride the same way. Okay, then there's the question that Paterno talked about, the isomers that you could get by rotating. So if we took these models, as Van't Hoff did in this picture from his book, you could imagine rotating the top one way, rotating the bottom the other way, right, and getting different isomers. That's what Paterno talk about. But what Van't Hoff says is the rotation should be free, so you shouldn't be able to get different isolated isomers in different bottles that way. But there is an interesting aspect of this if R1, R2, and R3 are not the same thing. Because the trace from R1 to R2 to R3 can either be clockwise or counterclockwise. And the same thing is true down here, from R4 to R5 to R6. It can be either clockwise or anticlockwise. So that means it might be possible to get isomers, right? Where one isomer has them clockwise, the other has them counterclockwise. And whether you rotate or not, it makes no difference. It's still going to be either clockwise or counterclockwise. So you can imagine the top being either clockwise or counterclockwise, the bottom being either clockwise or counterclockwise, which suggests then you should have four isomers. Right? Except you find out so that there should be clockwise, 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 and clockwise, counterclockwise. But if 1, 2, 3 is not the same as 4, 5, 6, then there turns out to be a fourth isomer, counterclockwise, clockwise. The question is whether those two are the same. And they'll be superimposable on one another just by rotating the thing end for end if 1, 2, 3 is the same as 4, 5, 6. What one is the same as four, and two is the same as five, three is the same as six, right? But if they're different, then you can't turn it end for end, and then there'll be a fourth isomer. So this counting isomers can verify this interpretation. A really risky interpretation, because no one had made anything like this, was in this model that he published in 1874, which shows three tetrahedra sharing edges. So two double bonds in a row. And although when you have just one double bond rather than two, then you don't have a carbon that has four different things, and the thing is identical with its mirror image. So here's the mirror right here. Right? There. Okay. But if you have this, the ones on the top and bottom stick in and out because of the twist that's involved with that center tetrahedron and two double bonds in a row. So these things called allenes should be able to exist as right and left-handed versions. He said you could have, because those are not superimposable on one another. The tops are superimposed, but not the bottom. Okay, and this was finally confirmed experimentally in this paper in 1935 by E.P. Kohler, who, remember, is your distant ancestor, right? So this was 61 years after it was predicted. That's one of the longest periods between a theoretical prediction and an experimental confirmation. So here you see is the molecule that was used. It's two double bonds in a row, and it has different things on this carbon and different things on this carbon. Notice they don't all have to be different from one another. These two are the same, both C6H5, but still it will not be superimposable on its mirror image. Now, if you look at this and have tetrahedral bonds at those carbons, notice that the bond at that last carbon looks like all the bonds are in the same plane, the plane of the paper, right? That can't be, we know now, because the p orbitals wouldn't overlap to make the double bond to stabilize those last electrons. So you would so that as Van't Hoff's model show, these have to be not in the plane of the paper, but in and out of the plane of the paper. So you'd have to rotate it like that in order to get a double bond, the second double bond. Okay. Now that means that it's not superimposable on its mirror image, right? In order to do it, you'd have to rotate around this bond, which means breaking the double bond so as to get a single bond that you could rotate, right? So you'd have to go like that, moving C10 up and then back, and now you have the mirror image of the one we started with. But you had to break the pi bond to do it, so it's going to be a difficult barrier, and they were able to show that it was possible to prepare those in two different bottles. Okay, now, with respect to mirror images, there's an interesting puzzle about mirror images. You know that mirror image exchanges right and left, but it doesn't exchange top and bottom. Did you ever wonder about that? Why the mirror image changes one but not the other? How about if you lay down and looked at your image in the mirror? Right? This seems weird. Right? So what's the answer to this puzzle? It's an obvious one when you come to think about it, that it doesn't change either. In the mirror, the top is still on top and the right hand is still on the right. What the mirror changes is in and out. Right? Because here in the real space, you see the back of my head. In the mirror image, you see the front of my head. So it's not right and left that gets changed. It's in and out. Okay? But so it exchanges front and back. But our intuition interprets this image as if it had been a rotation, because we've been able to see people rotate, but we've never been able to see people turn inside out, go and come out the other way, right? So it's our intuition that says that right and left have been changed. They actually haven't been changed at all. It's in and out that's been changed. And it's sort of fun to think about this. For example, in Through the Looking Glass and What Alice Found There by Lewis Carroll, there she is and she's holding up her right hand. And then you look at the other image that's in the looking glass and she's still holding up her right hand. I said in the looking glass. That's not the title of the book. The title of the book is Through the Looking Glass, right? So if she actually moved through the looking glass, then it would still be her right arm, right? So Lewis Carroll, as you know, was a mathematician at Oxford. It's interesting that John Tenniel, who did the illustrations, was blind in one eye. Maybe this gave him problems with three dimensions. Probably not, I suspect. We're going to talk about how to see three dimensions. But anyhow, the title is Through the Looking Glass. If the title were In the Looking Glass, right, then it would be the mirror image, right? And it would be her left arm that you would see in the other image. It would change right and left. Okay, well, that's just a little fun there. But the interesting connection to chemistry is this was 1872, which was just at the time that Wislicenus was doing this work on lactic acids. And Carroll was a good friend of Vernon Harcourt, who was a chemist at Oxford. So no doubt they had talked about the different versions of lactic acid and one being a mirror image of the other. So the text in this part of the book says, "Now, if you'll only attend, Kitty, and not talk so much, I'll tell you all my ideas about Looking Glass House. Well, then, the books are something like our books, only the words go the wrong way. I know that because I've held up one of our books to the glass, and then they hold up one in the other room. How would you like to live in Looking Glass House, Kitty? I wonder if they'd give you milk there. Perhaps Looking Glass milk isn't good to drink." Right? So almost certainly that's a reference to sarcolactic acid. Okay. Now, chirality. This is the concept of chirality, the property of chirality, which comes from the Greek chair, which means hand. Right? Like surgery is medicine that's practiced with your hands rather than with pills. Right, cutting things up and twisting them and so on. So it's the same root, care. Okay, so there's a right hand. Now, let's Lord Kelvin in 1893 coined the word chirality, saying, "I call any geometrical figure or group of points chiral and say it has chirality if its image in a plane mirror, ideally realized, cannot be brought to coincide with itself." So you don't worry about warts and stuff like that, okay? It's just, ideally, can they be brought into coincidence. So let's try that with a coordinate system, X, Y, Z here, and see what would happen if we changed the sign of all the X coordinates. So wherever X is positive, we make it negative, just as big. So what do we get? We get that hand, okay? That just changed right and left. X changed the sign of X. Okay, so that's the reflection you get in a mirror that's YZ. So change the sign of X, you get reflection in a YZ mirror. Does everybody see that? Okay, now, suppose you change the sign of all the Y coordinates up and down, right? Then you'd get that hand. And what does that correspond to? What kind of symmetry? Right? That's reflection in a horizontal mirror, the XZ mirror. Okay, everybody see that? Okay, now, suppose we change the sign of all the Z coordinates. Are you able to generalize now? Right? So then if we change the Z coordinates in and out, we get that, which is the reflection in a normal mirror, right? A vertical mirror. The XY mirror. Okay? Now, suppose we changed X and Y, so both right to left and top to bottom. Okay? Then we'll get that one from the one we're starting with back at the right here. Okay? Now, what does that correspond to? How do you get from this image to this image? Right, you do a rotation around the Z-axis. Does everybody see that? So if this is a right hand, these are all left hands. Those are mirror images, but that one's a right hand. Right? Rotation. Okay, then we could obviously change the sign of X and Z. And can you tell me quickly what that's going to do? That'll rotate around Y. Right? The vertical axis. And obviously we could rotate around the Y axis and then change the sign of all the Y and Z coordinates. And that we'd get that one, rotation about X. Okay, now there's one thing we haven't done. What's that? So all those ones that were rotation are still right hands, right? It was only the mirrors that changed right to left. Now, what haven't we done yet? Switch all of them, X and Y and Z. That one was rotation around X. So X and Y and Z. And that'll put it in the last octant up there. And is that a right hand or a left hand? Left. So if you change an odd number of signs, then you exchange right and left. If you change an even number of signs, it stays whatever it started with. Okay. So that one is inversion through a center of symmetry. If you take the origin there, everything that was plus, plus, plus becomes minus, 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 and so on. Right? So the thumbs correspond, the middle fingers correspond, and so on. Okay, so I have these. So chirality involves non-superimposable mirror images, like a hand, reasonably enough, since that's where the name came from. Notice that the right hand has only one mirror image. But using different mirrors to achieve that image gives the result in different orientations, right? There were three different ones we showed that were mirror images, but they're all the same as one another. Okay. Now, how special is this property of chirality? Will most molecules be chiral, or will most molecules be achiral? Right? Now, in the spirit of the times, we can decide this democratically by a vote. So how many people think that most molecules are probably chiral? 1, 2, 3, 4, I got half a dozen, 10, not less than 10. How many think that most molecules are achiral? Okay, that's 2-1, I would judge, with some not voting. Okay, so there's a democratic answer that it's pretty special to be chiral, right? Most things are not chiral. So the class, I was confident of this ahead of time, voted overwhelmingly there should be more chiral, achiral than chiral molecules. Well, let's, the voice of the people is the voice of God. Okay, so let's talk about words. So just two dimensions rather than three, which will simplify things a little bit. So let's play dice at noon, but keep it mum. Okay? Now let's change the sign of X. Okay, so we do that. And what do you notice? What word is special? Mum, right? So mum is its own mirror image. It's achiral. You call such things meso, right? Because they're like the isomer meso, tartaric acid, has that property of being its own mirror image. So the name was generalized. Okay, so mum is obviously special. But let's try another one. How about noon? Right? Is it its own mirror image? Can you superimpose those? Not in two dimensions, right? Okay, but there's still something obviously special about noon. Do you see what it is? Right. If you rotate, noon has symmetry, right? It has rotational symmetry. It's special in that respect, right? But still, it's chiral. It's not superimposable on its mirror image. It's like a hand in that respect, in two dimensions, right? So a propeller in three dimensions is chiral, right? It has symmetry. All the blades are symmetrical, right? But it'll go one way, not the other, when you spin it. Okay. And now, how about if we mirror by changing the sign of Y? So that's a horizontal mirror. What do you notice? Dice. Right? So dice is also achiral. It's a meso word. Right? But it was much harder to recognize at the beginning. When you looked at this, you could see that noon was symmetrical. I bet you could see that mum was symmetrical. But I bet you were unlikely to see that dice was symmetrical. Why do you think? It's because we're accustomed to vertical mirrors. We're not accustomed to using horizontal mirrors and looking for that symmetry. Okay? Now, how special is chirality? Right? It's not at all special. Most things, like most words, are almost all words are chiral. Achiral, these meso words like I or mum or dice, are very rare, right? It'd be a fun problem for you to think up another word that has this symmetrical property, okay? But it's the same with molecules. Almost all molecules are chiral, right? In fact, as I look around here, I don't think I see any thing that has a molecule that's except water, that's achiral. Okay? But when we deal with very, very simple molecules like water or methane or substituted methanes, we often encounter things that are achiral. But it's just because when we think of molecules, we think of very simple ones, that you have the intuition that most things are achiral. In fact, most things are handed. And that's very important in biology. So now we're going beyond constitutional isomerism, what's linked to what and by what kind of bonds, the nature and sequence of bonds, to talk about the arrangement in space, or what Victor Meyer called stereochemistry. Okay, so we first talked about composition, what elements and how many, right? Then constitution, the nature and sequence and bonds. And now we're into to stereochemistry, which is another kind of isomerism. Constitution already gave isomerism, right? Different ways of linking the same atoms. But now when you consider arrangement in space, you have two other C's, right? Which are configuration and conformation. And those are called stereoisomers because they have to do with arrangement in space. Okay, now the distinction between configuration and conformation is not really fundamental. It just has to do with what pictures we draw of the molecules, where we draw bonds, right? Because configurational isomers are ones where to change from a molecule to its mirror image, you have to break a bond, as in a model. Like this and this, right, are configurational isomers. Because I had to break a bond to do it. But this and this are not configurational isomers. I can do that just by rotating about a bond. Okay. So conformation has to do with rotating about single bonds. And of course this requires that you define what a bond is to talk about whether you're breaking it and so on. And although at first glance it seems simple, there are cases where you're not so sure, where resonance plays a role and you're not sure whether something is a single or a double or something in between. Right? But in general, breaking bonds is hard and rotating about bonds is easy. So configurational isomers are generally easy to put to separate and put in a bottle and they'll stay that way. But conformational isomers very readily interconvert, so you can't isolate them at normal temperature, typically. But there are obviously special cases. Now, notice that all isomers are local energy minima. So if you distort them, they'll come back, right? Not every arrangement of atoms is an isomer. Right, most arrangements would be distorted, and you'd let go, and they'd come back to the local energy minimum. But if it's a different local energy minimum from one start and the other, then those are different isomers, conformation or configurational isomers. Now, it's interesting to note that when you talk about stereochemistry and name things, you talk about relationships between things. So it's a relationship between two molecules. So two molecules that have, it's meaningless to talk about configuration and conformation if things have different constitution. If the linking is different, then obviously they're different. But the subtlety comes when it has to do with arrangement in space. So two molecules that have the same constitution can either be identical, that is superimposable, right? If you needed a name for that, you could call them homomers, which would be a stupid name. No one talks about it. They're just the same, okay? Or they could be completely different, right? And that the name for that, which is used, is diastereomers. And that comes from dia, which means across, and stereo in space, and mers, that's like isomers, the pieces. Okay, so they can be completely different, or they can be different in a special way. They can be mirror images of one another that are not superimposable. And those are called enantiomers, which comes from enantios, which means opposite. So there are two fundamental kinds of stereochemical relationships. There are things that are just plain different, diastereomers, and there are things that are mirror images, like my hands are, enantiomers. But notice that's a relationship between two things. So something can be both an enantiomer and a diastereomer. It's the enantiomer of something that it's mirror image, but it's a diastereomer of something that's just completely different. So remember when Lavoisier taught us when we're talking about things to talk about facts, ideas, and words, and the same applies in stereochemistry. They're the facts of whether things are identical or different. They're the ideas about arrangement in space, and then there are the ways we express it, which involves not words, well, sometimes words, but more often pictures or models like the ones I've been showing you. Okay, so let's look for things that give us hint about stereochemistry in a picture, in a 2D picture like this. So what is it about that picture that tells you about the Z coordinate? How is it coded? The size of the atoms, right? It's bigger when it's closer to you. Anything else? Pardon me? The angle of the bonds helps, especially if they're like a wedge, like that one, right? So you can see clearly, or that one, you can see that they're going in or out. Anything else that tells what's in front of something else? Yeah. Pardon me? The overlap, the things in front hide the things that are behind. So in a picture like that, there are a number of clues, size, perspective, obstruction, that tell you about that. Now, sometimes you have pictures that are presented like that when what people want to convey 3D information. Do you see how that works? You ever look at pictures like that? It's a stereo pair picture. One is seen by the left eye, the other is seen as the right eye. And if you can train yourself, I used to spend a little time in class training people to do this, because this used to be a more important skill, to see pictures in three dimensions than it is now. You can easily train yourself to have the right eye see one, the left eye see the other, but think they're on top of one another, and it springs into three dimensions, and when it happens, everybody says, oh, like that, okay. You've seen 3D pictures, I suspect. Or the movies nowadays are doing it again for the first time in 50 years, right? Okay, so you can have different images for the two eyes. So you can have stereo pairs. That's another way of doing it. But it's obviously much more difficult to draw such things. You need a computer generally to do it. Or this one. Now, that one is a little bit difficult to understand toward the middle. Will you agree with me? But watch what happens if I do this. And this is what's more common nowadays since we have computers. Now you can see that that thing in the middle has 8 bonds that point out toward the surface of a sphere. Right? So motion is a great tool for telling how far something is away. And Tenniel, the guy who illustrated Through the Looking Glass, could have done all these except the stereo pair, right? These others you can all do with one eye. So that's nice. Now how about this one? That's difficult to see generally what's going in and out. But it's easier with that. Why? Because you have highlights and you have shading, right? Or like that, it's even better, where they put little glints where the light's reflecting off these things. Or this one, right? So all these things that you can do with a computer now means that it's probably not really worth, even though it's a lot of fun, spending the time in class to learn how to make one eye look at one thing and one eye look at the other. Not everybody can do that, only about 85% of people or something. Now, usually on an exam, for example, you don't have time to do that kind of thing. Okay? So how do you draw 3D if you're just drawing on a piece of paper, a blackboard, or scratching in the dirt? Okay, you use dashes and wedges to show a tetrahedral carbon, right? So these are at a 109-degree angle. And this, although it's close to a 90-degree angle, has a wedge that means it's coming out, and that one means it's going back, so you can understand that that's a tetrahedron, right? Okay, 109-degree angles. Now, how about that one? Is that a good way? I guarantee you that all the examples here I've taken from exams. Okay? How about that one? Is that a good tetrahedral carbon? What's the shape? What is the arrangement of bonds at that carbon, as shown there? It's planar, right? Because this one's coming out to the right, that one's back to the left, so all four of those are in the same plane. So that's a crummy way to try to draw tetrahedral carbon. Or how about this one? Now we have in and out, right? But this bond angle is 180 degrees and the others are all 90 degrees, right? So that's obviously wrong. Okay, and how about that one? That looks pretty good, huh? Here's a 109-degree angle from here to here. Which bond is bad? The dash? No, the wedge is bad, because if this one is, the ones like this are in the plane of the paper. So this is in the plane of the paper, and this is pointed up toward us, but to the right. So this is a very small angle here, right? Much less than 90 degrees. So that one's obviously wrong. Okay? Okay. Now, how about this one? That obviously can't be right, really, because all these three are in a plane. right? This one's coming out, that one's going back. But nobody's going to laugh at you. If they'll laugh at you if you draw this one, this one, this one, or you'll lose points on the exam, which may be worse, right? But this one, people aren't going to complain, because that's trying to show something that you can't really draw well with dashes and wedges normally. And it's conventional to draw things where you have several rings together with wedges and dashes to show relatively, that is, it's understood when you draw that, that you mean these three all to be going back a little bit, and this one to be coming out. Right, so that's just the way you have to do it. But if you draw single carbons that way, people will not think you know what you're talking about. Now, a really important tool was invented in 1891 by Emil Fischer. He wrote, "With the help of Friedlander's convenient rubber models, one can construct models of right-handed tartaric acid, left-handed tartaric acid, and inactive tartaric acid," that's the meso one, "and lay them in the plane of the paper so that the four carbon atoms are in a straight line." Okay, so here's this thing. It's got an acid on the top, an acid on the bottom, and it's got, on this carbon, HOH, on this one, HOH, right? So that's what he's drawing there for one of those, right? But he says, because Friedlander uses rubber tubing to hold his models together, it's possible to twist it so that all the carbons lie in a vertical line in the plane of the paper. Right? This obviously is not an accurate picture of the tetrahedral carbons, because if you turn them this way, the bonds look really weird. Right? But the main thing is that these horizontal bonds on these central carbons go out toward you, as he says here. Okay? So the hydrogens and hydroxyls lie above the plane of the paper. So what he's really assuming is that you would draw nowadays wedges there for those two. So those are coming out. But the dotted bonds that he's drawn are really weird, as we've just seen. If you turn that 90 degrees, they're bent, right? The thing is highly distorted. But at least it shows the relative positions unambiguously. Right, it shows what is what related to its mirror image for each carbon. Okay, so that those bent bonds go back from both atoms, both the one above and the one below, and it was only possible because these models were made of rubber. Right, this incidentally came because Fischer and Beyer, his teacher, were on the Riviera, the Italian Riviera, at a resort, and they were trying to talk about how many isomers there were of some of these things, and they tried using rolls and toothpicks to make models, and they couldn't make it come out right. So then Fischer, when he got back home, figured out this way of drawing things, which is still used especially in sugars. Okay, so here are his things. Now notice something about a Fischer projection. If you can rotate it in the plane by 180 degrees, like this. Right? If you rotate it by 180 degrees, it's the same model, because this OH and OH are coming out toward you here, and they're coming out toward you here. But you can't rotate by 90 degrees, because the understanding is that the horizontal things are coming out toward you. So if you rotate just 90 degrees, the things that were out go back, and the things that were back come out, and you have the mirror image. You've changed the sign of Z. Okay, so you can do the same one for that, and the same one for this. Okay, so rotating by 180 degrees is fine, but not by 90 degrees. And notice that that one on the right, then, is its own mirror image after you've rotated. If you put this up here, up to the right, then it's the mirror image. Or, if it's its own mirror image, remember, it doesn't make, you get the same mirror image wherever you put the mirror. Right, it just appears in a different location. So on this one on the right, you could draw a mirror within the molecule, so the top would reflect into the bottom. So it's easy to see. If you can line up the molecule so it has a mirror within it, then it's one of these meso compounds where the top is one hand, the bottom is the other hand, and there's no net effect on light because they cancel each other's effect. Okay, so that one is inactive. Optically, that is, it doesn't rotate the plane of polarized light. It's the meso compound, and that became generalized then. It's in between being plus and being minus. It's zero. And the name then was generalized, so we called MUM a meso word, right? And DICE. Okay, and notice now we could name the relationships among these molecules. Like if we take those two molecules, what's the relationship between them? They could be homomers, that is superimposable. They could be diastereomers, just plain different. Or they could be enantiomers, mirror images. Right? Which are these two? We're naming the relationship between those two. Right? Right? They're mirror images. Right? There's a mirror there. Right? The OH is near, H far, and so on from that mirror. Okay? Now, how about, those are enantiomers. How about those two? Are they superimposable? No. Are they mirror images? No. So what are they? Diastereomers. Okay. Now how about the first and the last? Right? Those are diastereomers too. Okay. In fact, if these two are mirror images, then this one can't obviously be an enantiomer of that one if it's a diastereomer of that one. Okay. So... So these are names of relationships. You can't say this molecule is an enantiomer, or it's sort of silly to say it's an enantiomer or a diastereomer. It's the enantiomer of that, but it's the diastereomer of that. It names a relationship. Okay, now, counting isomers. If you have N, what's called, these carbons that have four different things attached to them are called stereogenic centers because they give rise to enantiomers. Right, so they're called stereogenic centers, or sometimes stereocenters. Okay, now if you have a bunch of them, if you have just one in a molecule, then you have it, and it's mirror image. You have two isomers, enantiomers. Right, but suppose you had two, or three, or four, or five, or any number. Right, then each of them can be either right or left. So if they're N stereogenic centers, there should be two to the N isomers. Each one can be either right or left. Or is that true? Right? No, because sometimes you get meso compounds, and then you're having right left would be the same as left right. Okay? And Van't Hoff wrote about this. He said, next we consider a symmetrical formula where you have a chiral carbon or a stereogenic carbon, CR123, then in the middle a carbon that has two fours, and then a carbon that has 1, 2, 3 again. Or the one where the carbon in the middle is itself a center with four different things, or are they four different things if they're both C123? That's an interesting question, because those two things that are both C123 here, does this carbon have four different things on it? It's got R4 and R5, but it has this and this. Are those the same or are they different? Well, are they the same hand or are they opposite hand, for example? And how do you go about counting things like that? So Van't Hoff said in 1877, as is easily conceived from the foregoing discussion, they lead to only three isomers for those two compounds. Now, is that true? Right? That's the point that Bayer and Fischer were debating at their resort down in Italy, because they couldn't figure out how you get only three isomers, but Van't Hoff was the big expert on this, so he must be right. So they tried with their rolls, toothpicks. Then Fischer got back and found out that you can do it quite easily. They gave up using the bread rolls. But you can do it quite easily with Fischer projections, the idea that Fischer developed. So let's see how to do it. So here's COOH on the top, COOH on the bottom, and then these three centers in the middle. And now we can draw out all two to the three, all eight possibilities here. Right? And then we can just systematically put things on. We can put on the first one, OH is to the right, and the second four, OH is to the left. Okay, that's the possibilities at the bottom. Then for the central carbon, we can put two to the right, then two to the left, then two to the right, then two to the left. And then finally at the top, we can put left, right, left, right, left, right. Okay? So now we've written out all two to the eighth. And now all we have to decide is if some of these are equivalent to each other. Now, none of them can be just shifted because we drew them in different ways, right? But some of them might be able to be rotated. So let's start out and count. So here, number one, we'll start with that one. That's clearly a starting point. Now, number two, is that the same as number one or is it different? It's obviously different. Okay? How about number three? Is it different from the first two? Yeah. And how about number four? Is it like one, two, or three? Patrick? Okay, we can rotate it by 180 degrees. And if you rotate it, these two will go here, and this one will go up here. So it's the same as two. So forget that one. Now, how about the fifth one here? Is it a fourth different one, or is it the same as one we already have seen? Can you rotate it and make it like any of the above? Elisa? Okay, if we rotate it like this, this OH will come here, this OH will come here, this OH will come there. Is that this? Wow. But you say you rotate it this way. Is that what you said? About a vertical axis. So I'm going to first rotate around the Z axis in and out of the board. That'll get the unique one on top and the other two on the bottom. But they're on the wrong side.
Yeah.
Now what do you want to do? Now, if you rotate around the y-axis, the things that are coming out in a Fisher projection will go back, and that's not a Fisher projection anymore. You can't do that one. You with me?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is in fact a new one, four. Now how about five? Is that five? Obviously, this is the one that's in question. Can you rotate this one and make it that? Yep. That'll do it. So that's the same as three. How about this one? Which one will it become, or will it? Becomes four. And the last one? Is one, obviously, rotated. Right? So Van 't Hoff, the expert, said there are three isomers, but in fact there are four. Right? He was wrong. So the bread rolls would have done it. It's just that they didn't believe themselves. Okay. Now, are any of these meso compounds? Do any of these have a mirror plane? How about number one? Is it identical with its mirror image? Amy, what do you say? Where would you put a mirror to make it superimpose? It's that horizontal mirror, the one Dice has, right? To take top to bottom, right? There's the mirror. So it's a meso compound. It's not optically active. How about, are there any others that are not optically active because they're meso? Obviously, in these molecules, the mirror has to be horizontal to take the top to the bottom, right? Does this one have a horizontal mirror? That one? Yeah, that one does. So, what's the relationship between these two? Let's shift it over there. Right, there's a mirror between those. So those are enantiomers. So there are two mesoisomers and a pair of enantiomers. So this is easy to do with Fisher projection, but these guys really got tied in knots when they were trying to do it with models. Okay. Now, I thought I'd get to this. This is a compound that has lots of chiral centers. And it's just about to be an important drug, perhaps. So we're going to talk about that one next time.